KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, sitting in for Sean Spruce. The number of children who died during the Indian boarding school era is at least three times the number documented in the recent Department of Interior's report. That's the conclusion of a year-long investigation by the Washington Post. After researching hundreds of thousands of documents, the paper's reporters say the number is at least 3,100 students. They say that is probably low. We'll hear about the investigation and talk about why getting an accurate accounting is important. That's coming up right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Ahead of the inauguration, people marched to the Lincoln Memorial Saturday, where they raised concerns about women's rights, the environment, immigration, and other issues. Demonstrators included Christina Diego, a member of the Colville Tribes. She moved to Washington, D.C. from Seattle to work on Indian health care issues.
We're all upset at the lack of policies and systems that support the mass population, and we're all upset and hoping for a better future.
Diego wants to advocate for the protection of health care for American Indians and Alaska Natives as the Trump administration takes office. Other demonstrators traveled from states across the country, including Arizona. Antietta Quesada, Mexican-American, is concerned about immigration policy.
We have a lot of family who have crossed over before and who honestly cannot cross over right now. So it's been really rough. That's what we're marching for today.
National groups are among those representing their organizations, like the Sierra Club. Elizabeth Scrafford is its Western Field Director. She says the organization is an ally of tribes, which have been
longtime natural protectors of our land, and how we learn from that wisdom, and how can we move together to try to protect the environment.
And Brittany Murray of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream was helping hand out free peace, love, and ice cream cups.
Ben & Jerry's support the people. They fight for our rights. They want equality for everybody, so they're down here marching with everybody. We're just here to meet them at the end to give out ice cream.
The march is said to have attracted thousands of people to the nation's capital ahead of Donald Trump's next term as president. Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy's staff says they haven't heard back from Trump's transition team about his Alaska Federal Transition Report, a 27-page wish list the governor sent to the incoming president just after his election. One of Dunleavy's top priorities is a request to reverse Biden administration policies that restrict oil development and return control of subsistence hunting and fishing to state management. KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports.
When the governor floated some of these proposals in the past, opponents didn't take them seriously. They said they amounted to political posturing. State Senator Donnie Olson says some of the oil development proposals might help his district on the North Slope, but he's worried about Dunleavy's push to return fish and game management to the state and do away with the Federal Subsistence Board. He recalls the bitter debates in the legislature in the 1990s that failed to reconcile state and federal laws and ultimately led to a dual system of fish and game management.
What I want to do is look forward and continue to move Alaska forward. Last thing I want to do is go back to those type of days.
The Dunleavy list of priorities also asked Trump to reverse Biden administration policies for Alaska on land into trust and Native allotments. If that happens, that might squash the Aklutna tribe's plans to build a small casino near Anchorage. The Alaska Federation of Natives has been working on a response to Dunleavy's request to the Trump transition team.
We just want to see a structure that works for Alaska Natives.
AFN's President Ben Mallott says much of what Dunleavy wants goes against resolutions passed at last fall's AFN convention that seek to strengthen Native access to hunting and fishing.
We are reviewing it, making sure that our communities, our organizations, our tribes have a seat at the table.
Mallott says it's also looking through the proposals to see if there might be common ground. Some of the governor's supporters praised him for reaching out early to Trump and identifying Biden policies that might quickly be reversed by executive order. When asked for comment, Dunleavy's spokesman Jeff Turner said the plan speaks for itself. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Educators, ready to transform Indigenous education? The NISN School Design Fellowship is accepting community letters of interest through January 31st at NACAInspiredSchoolsNetwork.org, who support this show. Looking to exhibit, enhance, or share your artistic talents and cultural knowledge? Crazy Horse Memorial has artist residencies, performance opportunities, and more. Application deadline is January 31st at crazyhorsememorial.org, who support this show.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support great causes like National Native News. Just select KNBA-FM Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. With your support, you can help us make a difference in our community.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. More than 3,100 Native children died at boarding schools created by the federal government. That's the finding of an investigation by the Washington Post that took more than a year of combing through public records to compile. The number cited by the Department of Interior in their investigation is under 1,000. The schools were part of a century-long effort by the federal government with the help of churches to forcibly remove Native children from their families and strip them of their culture. The investigation found that the causes of death included malnutrition, disease, and injury. We'll speak today with boarding school experts about why an accurate accounting is important. We also want to hear from you. Join this conversation with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. And a warning, this discussion might not be suitable for those sensitive to the issue of boarding schools and death. And in one of his last official acts in the White House, former President Joe Biden earlier today commutes the sentence of Native activist Leonard Peltier. The Turtle Mountain Chippewa tribal member was convicted of killing two FBI agents in 1975. Later in the hour, we'll get updates from his attorney and others about the decades-long effort to free him. Joining us today from Anchorage, Alaska is Benjamin Jasek. He's an indigenous researcher at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. He is Dena'ina Athabasca and Supiak. Welcome to Native America Calling, Benjamin.
Thank you very much, Andy. It's great to be here this morning.
Thank you for joining. Also from Anchorage, Alaska, is Jim LaBelle. He is a board member for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. He's a Nupiak. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Jim.
Yes, and thank you too, Andy.
All right. Well, you know, before we get started, let's hear now from Dena Hedgepeth. She is the lead author of the article published by the Washington Post. She's a member of the Haliwasaponi tribe. The investigation found three times the number of deaths in boarding schools than the Department of Interior's report. I spoke with her earlier about the discrepancy between the reported number of deaths.
The biggest difference is that the Interior Department found close to 1,000 children, as you mentioned, and they looked exclusively at federal documents. And so as they themselves said, it was limited in scope, and it didn't really tell the full story of the trauma of the Indian boarding school area. We took that a step further. My team and I, the Washington Post, we went through not just those 973 children in the Interior found, but we took it a step further by digging deeper into records at the National Archives. We looked through hundreds of thousands of pages there. We looked at census rolls, death records, death certificates, historical maps, archival newspaper clips, other work that had been done by local historians, tribal historians, and college professors. And then culling through all of that, we were able to come up with three times as many student deaths. We found about 3,100 students sadly died at these Indian boarding schools over a 150-year period.
Do you think your number is accurate, low, high?
You know, sadly, it's probably low. From the many historians and researchers that we talked to, the number is probably much higher than that based on their decades of research. It's definitely accurate, but the truth is that no one really knows. We're one of the first to do a real deep dive on the over 400 schools that were in the country. Others have done very deep dives, and it's been decades on this, but typically school by school or maybe by region, we tried to take a real comprehensive look at as many schools as we possibly could. So strangely, there's probably 6 more thesis papers to be done. There's still millions of documents out there at various sources that are yet to go through. We just had a set time frame that we wanted to look through these documents.
What have been the responses from the Department of Interior or others that have been leading research on this era?
You know, I think Secretary Nuland said it best. Brian Nuland, who led the Interior's 2 investigations, we quoted him fully in our second story on student deaths. He said, you know, this is the beginning chapter. This is not the end, and we feel the same about our work. These are building blocks for others to take that research that the Interior did, that we did, and take it further. There's still caches of documents at the Department of War, which was the original orientation of Indian boarding schools. We now know it as Interior Department, which took those over and ran them, but they have documents that haven't gone through. Churches, historical societies still have documents that haven't gone through. So there's potential to dig even deeper on this and sadly find more details of what happened at these boarding schools and the deaths. If I could circle back, you asked me about the end of this, and other people have asked me, you know, exactly how many children attended and exactly how many children died. No one really knows. Even the federal government has said themselves that there are not accurate records, sadly, on how many children attended these schools. And there's also not exact records on how many children died at these schools or exactly what happened to them. There are some historians who say that it's tens of thousands. One historian says it could be as high as 40,000. So, you know, we just tried to shed a light, as I said, in the period that we worked on our investigation and show what we did. But there's a potential to find many more cases of children's deaths at these schools. It's a lot of work still to be done.
What prompted your work into boarding school deaths? And can you describe the preparation and process for taking this project on?
Oh, well, good question. I mean, look, I'm Native American. So many of your listeners are as well. So these stories are not new in Indian country, right? They are not new to our histories, our families, our tribal ways of life. They don't get talked about sometimes as much as they should, obviously, because of the trauma, the hurt, the pain. They are very hard to talk about these times for many of our folks who attended these schools. I was invited to be a part of our investigative team. My colleague, Sari Horwitz, who has done a lot of work in Indian country on other subjects, she and I partnered up and we got with our data team and our visual forensics team and decided what is the best way that we can use our resources at the Post to really go deeply on these. We had done a prior piece in the summer about sexual abuse at the schools, and in that investigation, we found about 1,000 children had been abused at several dozen schools by over 100 priests, clergy, and nuns at those schools. So that was our first step of an investigation, and we wanted to look at the deaths because it's important to do. It's awful for anyone's child of any culture to have their children taken away. To me, there's nothing worse that really cuts to the core of hurting people more than taking their children. Those are the future. So that's how we started. And then we went through the process of sort of organizing ourselves to figure out how to best look for those. We had been in touch with the Fort Belknap community out in Montana for the first series we did on sexual abuse. And we kept in touch with them knowing that they were going to be going in the fall to Carlisle. And we asked if we could be a part of that journey. And it was just an epic, unbelievable journey filled with so many emotions and so powerful. They came from Montana to see 3 of their children be exhumed at Carlisle in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. As you know, that's the first off-reservation federal government Indian boarding school. And we were sort of flies on the wall in a way. We stood back and watched the tribe, about 18 tribal members and relatives of Almeda Heavy Hair. They watched her being exhumed and two other young boys who had sadly died at the school. And then in a four-day trip home back to Montana, they drove them in a truck and a caravan of SUVs. And we realized on that journey that that was the sort of thread and way to tell this story. I talked to so many researchers and tribal historians and leaders who would like to find their loved ones. There's so many loved ones that they don't know where they're buried. Our investigation found twice as many burial sites as what was listed in the Department of Interior's report. So there's still a lot of unknowns as to where all of those children's remains are. And so we tried to incorporate what we saw with the Fort Belknap tribe into the story to really make it personal, to humanize who these children were and what the significance of their sort of coming home and be reburied on their homelands meant. I think one of the most powerful points in the story is when that caravan comes through the Fort Peck Reservation, who long, long ago were once their arch enemies. And Fort Peck came out. It gives me chills now, and I run hot in droves. There were hundreds of people who came out Fort Peck the afternoon that we arrived, and they were honking their horns on the side of the road as the caravan drove through.
That was a taped interview with Washington Post reporter Dana Hedgepeth. A link to that article is available on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. The year-long investigation documents the causes of death at the more than 400 boarding schools created by the federal government. They range from malnutrition, disease, and a lot of suspicious circumstances. After the break, we'll talk with a boarding school survivor and National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition member Jim LaBelle, as well as Benjamin Jasek. He's an Indigenous researcher with the Alaska Native Heritage Center, who was cited as a source in the Washington Post investigation. We'll get deeper insights into the conditions that led to deaths at boarding schools with both of them after the break. We also want to hear from you. Join us with your comment and questions by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Even in the age of constant information, television remains a powerful window into people's view of their world. And Native American representation in TV is one way toward a more rounded perspective. We'll hear from Native people in front of the camera about the work they do on the next Native America Calling.
OCO. Resolve to live better. Set realistic goals and list the steps you'll take to achieve them. Not sure where to start? Contact your local Indian healthcare provider. Visit healthcare.gov/coverage or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. We're talking about a recent Washington Post investigation that found more than 3,100 Native students died during the Indian boarding school era. We're getting greater insights into the conditions at these schools, and we also want to hear from you. Join us with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Benjamin, you were quoted as a source in the recent Washington Post investigation on boarding school deaths. What's your reaction to the number of Native children that died in boarding schools? And are the numbers in your research different or similar?
Oh, well, thank you for having me on today. In terms of the Washington Post article, one thing that really encouraged by is being able to tell the truth and being able to tell a little bit more of a fuller story. One thing that came about when doing the research for the Washington Post and just research that we've been doing for over a decade over at ANHC really shows that while the Washington Post was looking at very specific instances, one thing that is for certain is there are a lot more of our own children out there from things like unmarked graves. And just like was said before, other really suspicious means of, you know, reports in terms of children that have passed away. And so just kind of like what, just repeating on what was stated before, while it's a really good base, there is a whole lot more work to be done.
All right. And what are your thoughts on the methodology used by the Washington Post to investigate these deaths?
I think it was fantastic. It was really thorough, especially since one thing that we saw happen in Canada was this questioning of whether or not some of these children actually passed away. And due to, you know, the boarding schools and those kinds of things, or elements connected to the boarding schools. And because of how thorough it is, it doesn't leave any room for questioning. An element of that is also when you have people outside of our communities questioning these sorts of things, you know, the existence of even the boarding schools. Whenever I talk to my own family about that, seeing that pain, that we all carry, show up in their eyes, and that, you know, even the existence of our own peoples are denied once again. And so their methodology and being incredibly exact, while at the same time having such a short time window, did a great service to Native peoples all across North America.
You mentioned pain that comes from, just being connected to these schools. And that could, I guess, be an issue sometimes for people who are looking into this, into these numbers, into the names and situations that come up in all of these documents. What are some of the issues or other issues that come up with trying to find graves of children at boarding schools, say in Alaska, where you're at?
Yeah. So Alaska, we don't have as complete of a road system as places like in Oklahoma, where, you know, we've done research in Oklahoma, it being somewhat of a place where a lot of these methodologies, templates for what the boarding schools would look like were developed. In Alaska, you have to fly to places, and especially since a lot of these places are for the most part, not maintained. The majority of the schools that were in Alaska, which on our count is a little bit over 100 schools, boarding schools within Alaska, a lot of them are not standing anymore. And so in terms of having to go and try and find an actual grave, a lot of these cemeteries, if they even existed, were really, that's a place where, you know, those have even gone missing as well, really contributing to the amount of unmarked graves within Alaska from erosion, at the same time, unintentional or very intentional unmarked graves existing throughout the state. And so in terms of even trying to find numbers of how many schools or how many children passed away via figuring out, you know, through finding a grave and death record, that for a lot of times doesn't really exist within Alaska, making our number a lot higher. And especially since, you know, at this point, not only in terms of how many, we are still trying to find how many children have gone missing or who passed away during the boarding school era. We're even still finding schools every day. And I know that's not only the case in Alaska, but all throughout the rest of the U.S.
Okay. What are, I mentioned, disease and, malnutrition being a cause of death, and then also a lot of suspicious circumstances and unknowns. And can you give me an example of, a couple of those maybe instances that can be categorized as maybe suspicious or just as like injury related death that is kind of encompassed in unknowns, I guess.
Yeah, in terms of looking at correspondence, that's where you find conflicting information. When there was actually a letter that was sent to their parents, a lot of the times they would reference disease as being the cause of death. When instead you would have correspondence between teachers, between denominations, between federal officials, where they would say the complete opposite in terms of the conditions for how a lot of these children passed away. And that really goes at the heart of a lot of this issue, where a lot of the times our parents, the parents never actually knew what happened to their children, or fed misinformation. Something with my own grandfather, great-grandfather, one of his kids got sent away to a Klutna, and we found in letters later he was writing the school telling them, this is not at all what you told me it was, and I want my child back. That's really an area where a lot of misinformation within even the records exist, but you start to see glimpses of the truth within their correspondence amongst each other.
Okay. So you have a paper coming up about boarding schools. Tell us about what you expect for the future regarding research being done at the Alaska Native Heritage Center on boarding schools.
So with the paper, we have a few papers coming out. But one academic journal is based upon the Comity Plan, COMITY, where it's the first instance, first recorded instance in history where not only Roman Catholics, but also Protestants got together and agreed on something. And that something was the splitting up of Alaska and using boarding schools to gain access to natural resources. Almost every time at the expense of our own peoples and even the children themselves. And so a big part of that in not only researching it, but also even finding the map that's been missing for about 140 years, really shed the light on how a lot of these denominations were not only working with each other, but also working with the federal government. And the more that we know about the structures of how this occurred, the more that we understand about every specific school. One thing that was very helpful during the investigation with the Washington Post for Alaska was if we were looking for a specific school, we just had to look at the Comity Plan map and see what church was over it, what denomination, and then at that point, then reach out to their archives and correspondence that sometimes they don't even know exist in order to get more information. And so just the thing that has already been stated is being able to, in the future of research in general, is us being able to understand, you know, why this occurred specifically to our own children. In terms of what we're also coming out with at the Heritage Center, we'll be hosting and continue to host oral history projects where we're talking with elders from a lot of these schools and recording their own stories.
Mm-hmm.
We also have an exhibit coming out concerning boarding schools in Alaska over in May. A lot more collaboration across the board, not only within Alaska, but helping to be able to tell the story of all of our peoples all across North America.
All right, that's Benjamin Jacek, Indigenous researcher at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. I want to bring in Jim LaBelle from the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. Jim, you're hearing about the Washington Post's investigation. They came up with 3,100, more than 3,100 names of boarding school students who had died while in boarding school. And that's a lot different from what the federal government came up with last year, which was around 900. What is your reaction to the number from the Washington Post, three times more than what the federal government came up with?
Well, thank you for that question. I really think that the Washington Post and Dana did a wonderful job of sleuthing and getting into the truth behind some of the work that was revealed. I don't know that a federal agency, as good as I think they're trying to be, just probably didn't have the resources or the time, energy, and people to do that kind of in-depth research. But that also tells us that it's still needed. We still need to continue to do this kind of work. There's probably so many different ways that children died and in so many different circumstances that it's still going to continue. There's still going to be a need for to get into some of those specifically in different areas because I think each area is different.
Mm-hmm. Why is it important to get an accurate count here?
Well, I think there's a tendency to just kind of lump us all into one category and kind of be done with this in a way. And there's... I can imagine every other census and group and studies were very, very good at enumerating births and deaths and these kind of things. So we should not be omitted from that work. We need to be counted just as any as anybody else would have been counted.
Okay. You've spoken candidly about your experience at boarding schools on this show. Is there more of an openness by boarding school survivors to share their experiences with radio shows like Native America Calling or reporters from the Washington Post? Do you think there's more of an openness by survivors to share their stories with the public?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I wanted to use that this opportunity to let you and the listeners know that it was 70 years ago that I was first sent away to boarding school in 1955. And I've always had this notion that for as painful of an experience that I had, I always strive to tell my story and tell the truth, and in hopes that others, I would give courage to others or enable others to tell their stories as well, because we need to have more of a voice across the country.
Okay. Well, we have a new president, Donald Trump. Do you expect future efforts in the years to come to acknowledge this history? Do you expect him to maybe continue the work that Biden and Holland have done to, you know, acknowledge boarding schools?
Yeah, at NABS, we strive to be nonpartisan in all of our efforts, and we are certainly hopeful that the Trump administration will continue the work of the Biden administration and Deb Haaland, but also perhaps even add to the work.
Okay. All right, that was Jim LaBelle from the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, or like he said, NABS. We're going to be back after this break. We're going to turn things over and talk about Leonard Peltier. You can join us by calling 1-800-996-2848.
What if education reflected the needs of your community? The NACA Inspired Schools Network supports Native communities by creating schools that are community-led and are rooted in academic relevance, identity development, and holistic wellness for their children. Ready to transform Indigenous education? The NISN School Design Fellowship is accepting community letters of interest through January 31st at NACAInspiredSchoolsNetwork.org. NACA Inspired Schools Network supports this show. The Alaska Native Art Auction Gala is March 21st, 2025 in Anchorage, Alaska. Please consider donating art and help Kowanic Broadcast Corporation raise needed funds. Kowanic Broadcast Corporation's mission is to be the leader in bringing Native voices to Alaska and the nation. With your support, we're able to produce such programs as National Native News, Native America Calling, and more. Donor forms and more information about the auction can be found at knba.org. Anyone who donates art before February 14th will be automatically entered into a drawing to win $500. Are you or someone you care about looking to take their education to the next level? Native Forward Scholars Fund is here to help. With awards up to $30,000, Native Forward Scholars Fund is dedicated to supporting Native students as they pursue higher education. With Native Forward Scholarships, you can overcome financial barriers and open doors to a world of opportunities. Native Forward Scholars Fund, working to build a brighter future and empower Native students one scholarship at a time. Info and applications at nativeforward.org who support this show. See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com. Educators, ready to transform Indigenous education? The NISN School Design Fellowship is accepting community letters of interest through January 31st at NACAInspiredSchoolsNetwork.org who support this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. We are talking about a recent Washington Post investigation that found more than 3,000 Native students had died during the Indian boarding school era, which is about three times more than what the federal government found last year. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. In a couple moments here, we're also going to talk about former President Joe Biden commuting the sentence for Leonard Peltier, Native activist who was serving a life sentence after being convicted of killing two FBI agents back in 1975. So if you want to join that conversation, you can also give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. I want to go back to Jim LaBelle from the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. Jim, this article really brings a lot to readers about experiences from students in the past who were in boarding school to whole tribes now who are repatriating remains of students from boarding schools like Carlisle. What is still not fully understood about this time in history? What would you like investigators and reporters to open up more about this time in history?
Yeah, thank you for that. I was trying to find a way to find a segue into the need to for researchers, archivists, reporters, journalists to also investigate the relationships that the federal government and the different church organizations had with each other and. I'll give you an example, like other institutions, mental hospitals. I still remember a kid from Wrangell being sent to the school from Morningside Mental Hospital in Oregon. And many years later, I started connecting the dots that there's a lot more of a relationship that different organizations had with each other that took care of either purposefully or inadvertently Native children. We need to do more of that, those kind of connections. there's over 5,000 Alaska Native people buried in Oregon, and many of those are children, and some of those must have had to come from or have been related to those in boarding school, for example.
All right. All right. Well, thank you so much, Jim. Right now, I'd like to talk about the big news today. Former President Joe Biden earlier today commuted the sentence of Native activist Leonard Peltier, who was serving a life sentence after he was convicted of killing two FBI agents in 1975. Joining us from Denver, Colorado is Jennifer Jones, a lead attorney for Leonard Peltier. Welcome to Native America Calling, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me today.
What were your initial thoughts when that news came to you?
You know, I thought it was unreal, and I couldn't believe it. I was happy for Leonard. I gave thanks to the Creator. I thought about today being Martin Luther King Day. I thought about Dr. King's speech in which he said, let justice roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. And today, justice, we can't say it was fully served, but a measure of justice has been served to Leonard after nearly 50 years of a denial.
Got it. I also want to bring in another guest we have here. Lenny Foster is a spiritual advisor for Leonard Peltier and a retired program supervisor for the Navajo Nation Corrections Project. He's Dine. Welcome to Native America Calling, Lenny. All right. Well, we don't have Lenny. We'll get him on in just a bit. But Jennifer, I wanted to ask you, what is the difference between commuting a sentence and a pardon?
Absolutely. A pardon on the federal level is something that happens after someone has, of course, been convicted and released. It is a form of admission of guilt. And folks are only eligible for it after 5 years of having been released, whereas a commutation is a form of executive action which cuts short the prison term, hence the name commutation.
Got it. Was this news expected at all?
You know, as much as it is, we were hoping, we were cautiously optimistic is what I could say. We would expect and hope that the federal government would act in a good way with respect to Leonard's clemency, especially at his age. However, we know the reality of how things have gone over these past decades. So we were cautiously optimistic.
All right. I'm going to bring in Moira Meltzer-Cohen as well, another attorney for Leonard Peltier. Moira, what were your initial reactions to getting the news this morning?
Honestly, I was stunned. I was speechless. I did not expect to experience euphoria today. I had really given up believing that Biden was going to take action on this because he really did wait until the 23rd and a half hour to do it. But, you know, after 50 years, I guess another few days didn't prevent us from getting the most just result that was available.
Okay. So you've, Moira, you've been a legal representation for Leonard Peltier for a while. Tell us about representing him legally. I know, you know, last July he was denied parole. Tell us how it's been to just be at his side there as his attorney.
Well, Jennifer is lead counsel and brought me on specifically to assist with parole. So, you know, Leonard has been in this struggle for far longer than just the 50 years that he's spent in federal prison. He was born only 20 years after Indigenous people were recognized as citizens of the United States. He was born in the height of the termination era of federal Indian policy, and he has struggled against those policies, which have been maintained in one or another form, really since that time. And so he's been a part of that struggle, and it really has been the privilege and the gift of a lifetime to sit with him and learn from him and advocate for him.
Okay. I'm going to go back to Jennifer. There's been organized efforts for years dedicated to freeing Leonard Peltier. Why now? Were there recent efforts that led to this move by former President Biden to commute his sentence?
Yes, absolutely. I want to, of course, thank the Indian Collective and the Ad Hoc Committee, which is Leonard's defense committee, and so many others that had a hand in this push. But I think in terms of the ecosystem, if you will, that politics and law came together in a way that helped to effectuate Leonard's release. Certainly the length of his sentence, his health, the unpredictable and shifting political grounds as they are right now, all work together, including the law, which has evolved over the last decade or so, which tends to support Leonard's release. And it's come together in this wonderful moment.
Okay. How is he doing right now? I understand he's been serving his sentence in Florida.
That's right. Leonard is incarcerated at USP Coleman 1 in Florida, in Wildwood, Florida. And that is a secure maximum security prison in which it's plagued with lockdowns, which is not ideal for Leno's health or age. He's bound to a walker. He needs a CPAP machine. He's a pretty bad diabetic. And he is also experiencing blindness in the way of cataracts, which have nearly entirely obstructed his vision. And so he is in need of surgery to remove those cataracts. And in need of a lot of care, physical therapy. The list goes on. Leonard's doctor, who myself and Maura retained, has done an excellent job, Dr. Joel Morrissey, and I'm so thankful to him for his work. And he went there every month to visit Leonard and to check on his health independent of what the BOP was telling us. And of course, Leonard is in need of immediate medical care.
All right, I want to go to a caller on the line. We have Paulette Doté. Paulette, go ahead, and what is your reaction to the news?
It was wonderful. It's been a long time. I've known Leonard for over 50 years and worked on his campaign along with my husband, Bob Robidoux, and it would be so wonderful for Bob to know that Leonard is free. And I've heard from, like, family of Bobby Garcia, who was the young man that helped Leonard escape, and his family is overjoyed. So we've talked to all the family members, and they're going to be there when they find out the final date when he's coming home. So it really, you know, it's overwhelming to think of what could happen. I mean, they have a home for him, so he'll have home confinement, but it'll be on Turtle Mountain, where his family and his sisters are still there. And so it will be wonderful. He's got grandchildren up there that will be able to visit him that couldn't get down to Florida. So it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful homecoming for Leonard, and it's just overwhelming, you know, to think I hadn't given up hope, but the hope was pretty low around Biden and his administration. So I have to give kudos to them finally doing the right thing and setting Leonard free. So he'll have home confinement, but he has family all over North Dakota that have been waiting for this for many years.
All right. Thank you so much, Paulette, for joining. I want to go back to Jim LaBelle. Jim, just before we started, you mentioned that you wanted to say something about Leonard Peltier. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, thank you. Yes, I agree with everyone in terms of just gratefulness and joy that Leonard is released. But I also want people to remember that Leonard was also a boarding school survivor. And there's a lot of things that play into many of us spending our early childhood lives in that way. And so in some respects, to understand Leonard must also include the time he was in boarding school.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jim, for that. I want to go just quickly to Jennifer. We're coming to the end here of our show. What's next for Leonard Peltier?
Well, what's next is his release and working out the logistics, of course, of his transportation and getting him comfortable and seeing to it that he receives the medical care, which has long been needed.
All right. All right, well, that is the end of our hour here. I'd like to say thank you so much for our guests who joined us. You just heard from Jennifer Jones, Moira Meltzer-Cohen, Jim LaBelle, Benjamin Jacek. We also did a pre-recorded interview with Washington Post reporter Dana Hedgepeth. We are going to be following this news about Leonard Peltier getting his sentence commuted by former President Joe Biden. There's been a lot of opposition to his release by a lot of folks out there, so that's up in the air as to how it'll be legally challenged or not in the future. So join us at 1-800-996-2848 for our next discussions for the rest of the week.
MFA programs at the Institute of American Indian Arts, IAIA, honor your voice and vision. IAIA is a tribal university whose low residency programs empower artists, writers, and community leaders through innovation and indigenous-centered education. Whether your path is creative writing, studio arts, or cultural administration, IAIA fosters respect, dialogue, and community. Applications accepted through February 15th at iaia.edu, who support this show. Repatriation is the return of ancestors and stolen culture. The Association on American Indian Affairs and the Tunica Biloxi Tribe will host the 10th Annual Repatriation Conference February 25th, 26th, and 27th, 2025 in Marksville, Louisiana. The conference will provide expert hands-on training about domestic and international repatriation. Registration and more information available at indian-affairs.org. The Association on American Indian Affairs supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.